Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the January 19th City of Bellevue Human Services Commission meeting. My name is Ben Piper, and I'm the chair of the commission. This evening's meeting and future meetings will be held remotely via Zoom in order to comply with the governor's emergency order concerning the Open Public Meeting Act, which prohibits in-person meetings. This meeting is scheduled to end at 8 p.m. I will now call the roll. Vice Chair Amir Fais.
I'm sorry, I was trying to unmute here.
No problem. Welcome. Commissioner Ma?
Here.
Commissioner Mansfield?
Here.
Commissioner McClure? Sure, it looks like you're on mute as well.
Here, sorry, had trouble.
No problem. Commissioner Mercer?
Here.
Okay, and I did hear that Commissioner Fawn has an excused absence this evening. Okay. As a reminder, because in-person meetings are prohibited by the governor's emergency order concerning the Open Public Meetings Act, the Human Services Commission is holding meetings remotely for an unknown period of time. The bylaws of the Human Services Commission regarding remote participation and the order of business have been suspended until such time that we are no longer holding meetings remotely. I understand that there are no minutes to be approved this evening. Staff, are there any written communications submitted for today?
No, they're not.
Okay. Any communication? Let's see. Is our council liaison, Deputy Mayor Neuenhaus, present to make any comments?
I have not seen him join yet. I didn't receive a message, so we'll just keep an eye out to see if he's able to join us.
Good. Any staff reports?
Not from me, thank you.
Okay. Any commissioner reports? All right. So that brings us to the information for the commission this evening. We have a presentation on issues and trends for individuals with disabilities. Tony, would you please introduce our panelists for the presentation?
Yes, thank you, Chair Piper. So tonight we have a panel of providers that provide services to Bellevue residents with disabilities. Each provider was asked to address 5 questions in their presentation this evening. Number 1, what services do you provide to support residents with disabilities? What unique challenges exist for our residents with disabilities both before and now during the pandemic? Number 3, how is your agency addressing equity in your service provision? Number 4, what gaps exist in the community for services for residents with disabilities? And number 5, what barriers do these individuals face in accessing services? Each of our providers is going to share with you, and we'll have about 15 minutes to share, and then we will open it back up to the commission for questions. To our panelists, when you are approaching the end of your time, I'll give you a warning just so that you're aware of that. And so we are going to start with Community Homes, and I will introduce their staff first. I see Vicki Isett, the executive director. I'm not sure. Vicki, is Helene here with us as well?
Helene was not able to join us tonight.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, and I'll turn it over to you and let you get started. And so you can feel free to share your screen for your PowerPoint.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see if I'm adept enough to do that. There we go. Community Homes is a nonprofit. We were formed in 1995 specifically to develop community-based housing for adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Vicki, we don't see, does anybody else see their PowerPoint?
No,
we do not see it. If you are having any problems, I can also.
Why don't you give it a shot?
Okay.
I'm not sure how to share my screen otherwise.
Yep,
I got it. I'm sorry.
No worries.
Operator error.
Every platform is so different.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So let's see. see how we do here. And now my little thing went away. I really apologize, guys. I'm not the most adept at this. Okay.
You're doing great. Thank you so much.
Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
All right. So I am the executive director for Community Homes. I've been with the organization for 13 years, and we focus exclusively on housing for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. These are a few of our residents. If you look in the upper right-hand corner of your screen, those women are all in one of our three Bellevue homes. So our homes provide 24/7 care. They provide all meals and all of the personal care support services that people need to live their best life in the community. Most all of our residents work, and so we coordinate with their employers. Many volunteer and partake in community activities. We have really enjoyed our partnership with the Highland Center, which has done a great job during the pandemic. These are more of our residents. The ladies in the upper left also live in Bellevue, and the three guys in the upper right recently moved from Bellevue to Redmond. So as you can see, we do lots of fun activities. We find that the unique challenges facing the folks that we serve are really a lack of affordable housing. We want everyone to be able to live in the community. And as we all know, there are many typically abled people, call them neurotypicals, who are unable to afford community living as well. So we have found ways to utilize both public funding, state and county monies, as well as cities to purchase homes so that we can charge only a very affordable rent. And we hire folks to be caregivers, and we offer them live-in positions so that they have a vested interest in the home, in the residence, and in the community in which they live. And that combination has enabled us to, well, along with a lot of fundraising, has enabled us to serve people without charging them more than they can afford. Most of our residents are at or below 30% AMI. So we have three homes in Bellevue for a total of 10 homes, and each home is has up to 5 individuals living there. One of our newer homes in Newcastle has only 3 folks. That is the single story home that you see in the upper right. And we have found that for people who have more personal care needs, a smaller setting is more conducive to really meeting their needs on an individual basis. So that was a new venture for us in 2020. We've opened one new home in 2020 and one in 2021. So we're pretty proud of having been able to expand our capacity during the pandemic. Wouldn't recommend it, but we did it anyhow. The other part of our services is what we call housing readiness programs. And what you see here is a Zoom screen for one of our housing workshops. This has been a phenomenal way for us to do outreach throughout the state. And it has dramatically, the Zoom format has dramatically improved our ability to reach a wide diversity of communities. We've done workshops in Spanish. We've done some workshops with Somali families through the Arc of King County. And we are currently expanding into Snohomish County with the intention of partnering with the Tulalip tribes. So those are a few of the things that we have been able to do thanks to Zoom. As much as we all kind of hate it, we also kind of love it. Because for families who have kids with disabilities, it means they don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to make sure that their son or daughter has some place to be for the evening. They don't have to arrange for any particular accommodations, and they can learn in the comfort of their own homes. The housing workshops really arose because of the complexity of developing housing for people with disabilities. Housing is not an entitlement in Washington State. And so of the 25,000 adults with disabilities in Washington, 13,000 of them live at home with either their parents or a relative. That's a huge number. And as you can imagine, if something happens to an aging parent, then that individual with a disability loses both their home and their caregiver. So this is a real crisis, and we wanted to empower families to with all the tools and the skills and the hope to be able to go out and create housing on their own if that's what they choose to do. We recognize that as a local nonprofit, we can't possibly create enough housing for 13,000 people. And that number is growing all the time, as we know. So in 2021, we served 348 unduplicated individuals through our housing workshops. And those are all people who attended multiple workshops learning different aspects of how to navigate the housing journey. We currently have over 160 people on our wait list. We're not allowed to call it a wait list, according to DSHS. And so we call them interested individuals in our database. But that's just as a result of our housing workshops, that 160, or roughly half of the people who attended our workshops last year, said, yes, please, I need housing for my son or daughter within the next 1 to 2 years. Help us. And because Medicaid rates are low, and that's the finance stream for adults with disabilities, then we find that most adult family homes are unwilling or unable to take adults with disabilities. And even those who are willing to take someone with a very low daily rate, that's not a peer group for a 25-year-old with Down syndrome to be living with 80-year-olds who are experiencing dementia and whose lives are closing down. As you can see, we have really vibrant young adults. Many of them have been with us since 1995. So we serve people for very long time periods, and we give them the opportunity to have a great life living with their peers. All of the community activities that they engage in are things that Community Homes has created for them. And we really stepped that up during the pandemic. Most of our residents work. And prior to the pandemic, they engaged in lots of community-based activities. During the pandemic, virtually everyone's job came to an end, at least a temporary halt. And so we created a resident services program, and it was on Zoom, and we had dance parties and treasure hunts and trivia nights and bingo games. My dog and I were part of the bingo game. So we had a really great time with that. As things have reopened slowly, we've been able to rent movie theaters where just our residents attended. And we have done a few limited outdoor activities. We've cut back on those once again with Omicron, but have been able to at least fill some of the gaps and help our residents feel connected, not just with the other folks in their home, but with the larger community as well.
Vicki, you have about 3 more minutes.
Well, I'm pretty much done.
Oh,
this is,
goodness.
This is okay. My last slide. So,
well, keep sharing, please.
You know, we've got about 50 residents right now. And as I said, we serve about 350 families throughout the year with our housing workshops. The one thing that I failed to mention is that we also have a monthly networking meeting for those families who attend our workshops, where they can talk to each other. They can go in depth on a particular topic. They can network. They can explore whether their sons and daughters might want to live together. You know, we've found that people are forming some really nice social connections with each other and pursuing housing together. And some of our families who have attended our workshops for a couple of years have indeed created housing on their own. A couple of them have moved into a Community Homes house. As I mentioned, we opened 2 new homes in the last 2 years, and we're working on another one this year. So people are finding housing, but it's a real struggle for families, because they're really left on their own, and we try to fill the gaps for them.
Thank you, Vicki. If you want to go ahead and exit your PowerPoint, Chair Piper, I'll turn it back over to you to see if you all have any questions.
Well, thank you, Tony. And thank you, Vicki, for that presentation. I just have one. You talked a little bit about, you know, the impact of COVID on your residents. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned that, as is the case with many, you know, most of the residents lost their jobs when the pandemic first hit. Can you talk a little bit about the toll, the physical and mental health toll that the pandemic has taken on your clients, on your residents?
It's been tough. One of the first things we did when everyone learned that they were not going to be able to continue going to work was to hire a mental health professional to address their concerns about, number one, about their well-being. I think along with the rest of us, they were pretty terrified about what it means to be living in a global pandemic. And so we had a couple of virtual meetings on just how to keep yourself safe. and following that, the same individual hosted a meeting on coping strategies and wellness, and our resident services Zoom meetings really grew out of those first two. They were more like workshops or seminars for mm-hmm. our residents. But in addition to the social activities and just kind of lightening the mood, we did this twice a week. We would also host chat groups so that our residents could talk to each other and they could share what they were looking forward to and what they were worried about and how they passed their time. And one of the beautiful things that came out of that was that some new friendships were formed. And so we had a couple of, you know, really, really bright spots grow out of that. I would say everybody experienced depression and anxiety. And people with disabilities were no exception. But through the efforts of their live-in caregivers and the efforts of my staff, who really worked hard to come up with fun things to keep people engaged and kept modifying it along the way, everyone's doing pretty well, and many folks are back to work at this point in time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Any other commissioners have questions for Vicki?
Yeah, this is Tim. I have a question, Vicki. Thank you for your presentation. I was wondering, when you workshop with other families to find housing for them, can you give an example of a solution that they come up with? Are they pooling money together to find a home? Are they, what's an example of a solution that comes out of that?
One of the housing models that Community Homes developed over the last 5 years or so was to have two or three families join together, rent a house. And the picture I shared of the three guys who formerly lived in Bellevue is such a household. So families join together, rent a home, and hire a caregiver to live in with their sons or daughters. They use Section 8 housing vouchers, King County Section 8 housing vouchers, to rent the home, which makes the rent affordable. And then they use Medicaid personal care hours run through First Choice In-Home Care, which is a Bellevue organization, to compensate the caregiver. And if you are an individual with a disability, you can add a caregiver to your Section 8 housing voucher, so it makes a nice compensation package for the caregiver. They're also entitled to food benefits. And again, these are all folks who are at or below 30% AMI. So we teach them how to access Section 8 housing vouchers, how to recruit caregivers, how to get signed up with First Choice to manage the payroll, and how to access food benefits. And that can create a stable, affordable living situation. And that's what a number of families have been able to do as a result of going through our housing workshops.
Thank you.
Any other commissioners have questions? Well, again, Vicki, thank you so much for the presentation. We really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Our next guests are from Hero House, and our panelists are Isabel Kalisa, please forgive me if I did not pronounce that correctly, the Director of Community Partnerships, and Kim Redig, a member of the Clubhouse. Let me know if you have any challenges in sharing your PowerPoint.
Okay. With us, we have George Hembley, who wasn't here when you took the names. At Hero House, we and Bellevue Clubhouse, we always work together, staff and members. And so I'm staff, and this is Kim, and there's Joe here.
There we go. This is Joe. He just joined us. Thank you, Tony.
The clubhouse always, the motto is that staff and members work together. And so here we are working together, and we will go to the next
one. Okay. Sure. Mm-hmm. What is clubhouse? Clubhouse is an evidence-based rehabilitation program for adults living with mental illness. We are located, the Bellevue Clubhouse is located in Factoria. We have over 800 members that we serve in the community, adults over 18 living with mental illness. And we've been accredited for 16 years. We have, like what Isabel said, a work order day where everybody that does come has an opportunity to participate in the function of the clubhouse. We work again side by side, regardless of your illness or staff or a member. We establish real meaningful relationships. If you do come with a mental illness and join, you're amongst other people that you can just be yourself and feel comfortable or participate in tasks that you can sign up to do during the day to support Clubhouse. We provide a non-clinical environment. We don't provide psychotherapy or medications or things like that. We connect members to community resources, and that includes housing, education, and employment. And we're looking for more support with housing at this time as we're struggling in that area. Membership is free, and it's regardless of insurance. Once a member, you're a member for life, and you can go to any clubhouse and participate in their work order day. There we go. Accredited clubhouses. Isabel?
There are unfortunately only two accredited clubhouses in Washington. But there is a few others now that are under Hero House in other parts of the state that are not yet accredited. They are new. We have standards that we adhere to that are set up by the International Clubhouse. And those are accredited every 3 years.
Okay. Day at the clubhouse. You want to also contribute to what's the day at the clubhouse? You can do that there. This is Joe.
Sure. Yeah, so the a day at the clubhouse involves working side-by-side with members as well as working with the staff. And there basically, there are no areas that are off-limits to participation. And the normal working hours are essentially like 9 to 5. And it involves real work experience for people. For instance, let's say like doing cashiering, maybe doing a little bit of bookkeeping, answering phones, running a snack bar, doing dishes. So these activities can serve as training for them perhaps in the future for some real world experience. And there's also meetings. And there's definitely a schedule to things. And so people, get train themselves in meeting deadlines and what have you.
Thanks, Joe. Social programs, Isabel?
So because the weekdays are basically for work, we do not have, we don't play it. We come here, and what the clubhouse is known for is the work order day. In other words, as Joe said, people come here to work and participate in running the clubhouse as members. But every Thursday, 5 to 8, we have socials that people can select on what they want to do. It could be playing games. It could be going to a movie when that existed. It could be arts. It could be baking. We sit together and decide on what socials we want to have. Again, staff and members work together to select the socials that we want to have. Since COVID, we've decided to have socials every Saturday just because people really need to get out, and most of those are done outside. And any major holidays, we are open because there are some people who do not have any other place to celebrate that. Yeah.
Okay. Employment at the clubhouse. What does employment have to do with mental illness? Well, if you're mentally ill, it doesn't mean that you can't work or be participating part-time. Some members can work more than that, but there's a lot of things involved with that. Personal management, having a job increases self-confidence, self-care, and there's a lot of challenges and benefits to working. You get somebody, a member that is in isolation a lot, and having a routine outside the home working is very rewarding. We work with employers and have a three-step transition program that begins that process. Isabella's going to talk about that.
We have three different types of employment. We have what we call the transition employment, which is where a position actually belongs to the clubhouse. And so this is for members who haven't worked for a long time or who have never worked, and they're not ready to be interviewed, but they can do the work. So we have two staff members that will do the job and train the members. So when the staff are working, the member is being trained, but he or she is being paid because the job is being done. And this goes on until when the member is ready to do the job on their own. Now, if a member gets ill and they have to be in a hospital for any reason, the staff will cover the job, the position, so that the employer does not lose, but they do not pay for the period the member is not there to work. Then we have the supported employment, where a member is actually qualified to do the job, but they just need accommodation. And this is where the clubhouse will advocate for them for whatever accommodation that's needed. But they have to be the best candidate for the job. It's just their accommodation needed because of the mental health problems. And then we have independent, where a member may have found a job on their own, but they need support of the clubhouse. And then the clubhouse has benefit planners who will work with the member to make sure that if they are on any Social Security benefits, they don't lose their benefits and they can still go to work. We have standards that are specific to employment that we adhere to make sure that members actually get to go to work.
Education at Clubhouse is amazing. We have opportunities for people to work with DVR for interviewing for scholarships to go to Bellevue College, or the University of Washington. We also assist members in receiving their GED. We have resources for those achievements. We also assist with continued education, and we also have a list of resources for education in the community. We work with Bellevue College and the YWCA, YMCA, and it's always available to the members to review and participate as they need.
Isabel, Kim, and Tom, you have about 5 minutes left.
Okay, we're about there. You want to go to housing?
Yeah, housing has been one of the problems that we are dealing with, in that we try to work with the agencies that do housing, like the Congregation for the Homeless, for those who don't have housing here. That has been a huge problem. We don't always get to find the housing that our members need, as some of them cannot stay in a shelter because of the mental illness, the noise, that becomes a challenge. And that's one need that we have to get a solution for. We are trying to find at least one house that we can house, that can house our members, those who cannot stay in a shelter while they're looking for their own housing. That's a big problem that we're still missing.
How to enroll? Joe, do you want to talk about that?
So the way it works is that someone who is interested in joining will come and set up a tour, and then one of the members, which is going back to this work order day, it's like considered one of the jobs that people have at the clubhouse. So one of the members will be the tour guide, let's say, and they'll come in and give them a tour, show them the various departments. And so that's just a good way for people to meet members and then also understand about how the clubhouse functions.
I should say that our membership consists of people who may have not completed high school, but we also have people who have their masters and the PhDs. As you all know, that mental health does not discriminate. We have people from all sorts of works, and we get to find jobs that range from the factory to offices to anywhere, and anybody out there who's willing to give us jobs, we always look for more.
Okay. You can contact our program, Bellevue Clubhouse, Seattle Clubhouse, and Everett Clubhouse. We're again open 9 to 5. Bellevue Clubhouse, that's where we're at right now, is just in Factoria. You can call or come in anytime and have a tour or schedule a tour.
Any questions?
Thank you very much to Isabel, Kim, and Joe for the presentation. Let me open it up. Do any commissioners or staff have questions for the panelists? I do have one question. I'm very interested in the sort of external employment opportunities that you talked about, the transitional employment, supported and independent. I'm curious if there's a challenge in finding open positions for that. And I ask this kind of in the context of the market now, where there's so many staffing shortages. Are you finding challenges in filling those, or has that provided a more opportunity?
We have many opportunities for supported employment, but still we're having more challenges now with the transition employment, as obviously this involves more than one person going to it in the beginning. But supported employment, we are actually getting jobs now. And we're understanding that when you get our members into jobs, you have qualified people that may need accommodation, but they will be there for a very long time.
Thank you so much. Any other questions from the commission?
I had a question. This is Samire.
Hi.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you do. It's very impressive. Can you tell us a little bit more about the range of diagnosis for your members? And also, what do you do when they decompensate, and do you require med compliance?
So the diagnosis for mental illness is a very wide range. And the only thing that qualifies anybody to be a member here is that you have that mental illness. Could be depression and anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia. It's the whole range. Anybody who has a mental illness is allowed to be a member. And once they're here, we do not really focus on the diagnosis. We focus on what people are able to do. And if for any reason there's any need to communicate with a mental health provider, we share resources with the mental health providers. So we would know how to contact them and to make sure that somebody gets help.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Well, again, thank you so much for the work you do and for the very insightful presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Our next presentation is from Open Doors for Multicultural Families. And we have Ginger Kwan, the executive director, here with us this evening. Welcome, Ginger. And let me know if you have any problems sharing your presentation. Looks great. Thank you.
Myself. Okay, good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, thank you for this opportunity to be here with you. And it's great to see a few familiar faces here, Samara and Vicky and Lisa. Nice meeting you again here. Open Doors for Multicultural Families is a grassroots community organization serving a lot of families who have individuals who have different mental or intellectual disabilities and their families, particularly those who come from linguistically and culturally diverse backgrounds. You know, for this population, I would say it's very close to me because I'm a parent who has a child, now is an adult, actually 26 years old. He has autism. So we started in 2009 at my home. And the reason why we started is really, you know, as an immigrant myself, experienced the challenges navigating the developmental disability system and trying to find the resources helping my son in school and also later on in many other areas, or like healthcare or employment or other recreation, all those kind of things. And it's really challenging. And so, you know, throughout the years after I worked for probably about 10 to 15 years, and then we decided that it's time that we need to do something to help this population, because the population we serve are this intersectional group who has developmental disabilities and also have the language and cultural barriers. So on top of that, you know, if they all are also low income, then the challenges are even more. So for the purpose, we started Open Doors in 2009. And this is a kind of brief history. We started at a humble place, which is my basement. And then gradually, slowly, we got some grant from the federal government. And we are able to serve families, become a community resource center. And then on top of that, we also are blessed to start to have a youth program. So we started to also thinking about how we can do a better job to collect all our data. And the different programs started to, you know, started to form afterwards. And the most recent milestones we have achieved is the statewide legislation on the language access. And the bill provides opportunities for parents who have limited English proficiency in school setting to have a meaningful conversation with school. And so we are very happy to see that now the legislation continued to move forward, and many agencies, government agencies or schools, started to have more conversation about the language access. So more families who have limited English proficiency can get the meaningful language support and they will be able to communicate with the schools more effectively. And Open Doors, we envision that all the people, doesn't matter where they are, where they come from, if they have developmental disabilities or intellectual disabilities, they can thrive in the community of their own design. So it's based on their needs that to build a place that meeting their needs and where they feel comfortable, culturally, and are able to communicate with neighbors where they feel belong and they can contribute to the society. And we, to do our work, to accomplish the work we are doing, we use this what we so called a cultural brokerage model. And a simple way to put it is that we try to hire people who represent and reflect the community we intended to serve. So that means if we see a lot of families now come to us, speak Somali, for example, then we will go ahead to hire somebody who come from the Somali community and has understanding of their cultural perspective of disabilities and bring them on board and start to serve this population. So we have many staff, what we call the family support specialists. They have been helping families one-on-one to navigate the system, connected them to healthcare, to resources, and to education, and even accompanying the parents to go to their children's IEP meeting for every student who has a disability qualified for special education. They have this individualized education program. So we have the connections. We are providing the support for families to communicate with families and being their emotional support and also guide them through the process in many ways. We also, based on the families and individual person with disabilities feedback, then we create the specialized program that is meeting their needs. And then on top of that, as I say, try to advocate for the system change is one of the pillar of our mission, because we know through the individual support and programming, we can help to the limited number. But if the system is not changed, if the system did not understand the challenging barriers that the families we are serving encountering, then likely the challenges families have continue to existing. For example, if they don't provide information in their language, or if the program design does not consider their unique situation, and then we will go to talk to the decision makers and the legislators and share their stories, and on top of that, helping the individual to share their thoughts so the policymakers understand how they can make changes in terms of the budget or investment or the program design that can meet better of their needs. So these are the things we do to advance our vision and mission. And, these are kind of summary currently in our staffing team is about, I think, 52 plus. There are 504 interns. And altogether, our staff speak about 19 different languages currently, and this number kind of fluctuates up and down as we continue to hire people or some people leave. And then 93% of our staffing are people of color, and 61% are immigrant and refugees, and 38% are parents who have a son or daughter with disabilities, and also persons who have disabilities themselves are part of our staffing. And program-wise, currently, these are the programs we have because we know developmental disability is a lifelong issue. The intellectual differences or their ability is not today is like this, tomorrow they will be changed. It's very consistent throughout their life. So basically, we want to provide a lifespan approach type of services to address the needs of the individuals who have disabilities at their different age stages, per se. So for example, the early learning program, currently we are doing the developmental screening in many different languages, and those are the language we help to translate and approve those languages. So people who speak different languages, for example, Somali, Spanish, Vietnamese, Chinese, and these are some of the languages, and also Arabic are the languages the developmental disability, the early developmental screening tool are in those languages and allows parents to participate fully to share their thoughts. And we also work with early intervention programs such as CTC, that's children's therapy in Kent. So in partnership, we are able to help the families to receive very relevant early intervention services. And also through the partnership, we are able to help these families who have young children easily transitioning from first to three early intervention services to public school or to other childcare setting or other services. So the services for young children can be seamless before they go to public school and get the resources they needed. And then to support families wise, we do the one-on-one system navigation as what I just shared with you. We also have a homelessness prevention program supporting families who are at imminent risk of being homeless. So we can help families go into a safe environment. For example, 2 years ago, there is one family has three children with disabilities. And unfortunately, something bad happened to them. Their apartment got burned down. And immediately they couldn't find the places. And with a program like this, we are able to have a case manager work with them and get the resources they needed and put them into a hotel for a few days and then find a permanent housing situation for them. And the case manager were able to get the furnitures to furnish this place for them and also put in additional resource fundings that is flexible for them to buy food or to get their, get some clothing for them and, with their basic needs, a grocery or stock up for them. And that is because of the program we are serving, understand the needs of people with developmental disabilities. So that is pretty unique in that way. And we also do parent trainings and also parent support group that is in different languages. So parents can easily communicate with others in their language. And then we also have a youth program. Our youth program has been focusing on how can we prepare our youth start at young age to feel confident about themselves. Through a friendship circle, our youth learned the valuable things about themselves and build up self-confidence and also envision what's possible for them in the future. So many of our youth who has participated in our program have graduated to go to college or go to work directly as well. And we also have the case management program that's supporting youth who are at risk of being kind of dropping out from school or those who are already engaged with the juvenile justice system. So we are able to support them.
Ginger, you have about 3 more minutes.
Okay. And so for the adult learning and also senior program wise, we also trying to help the families who are senior and taking care of their young children, taking care of their adult kids as well. And we have day learning programs allows adults to communicate and also socialize with others and also have opportunity for them continue to learn. And the advocacy and civic engagement program that I already shared that with you, besides advocating for the system change, we also provide the leadership training, help families to learn how to advocate and engage with the legislators. So these are the services we have. Pretty easy to show you this, sorry. In 2021, these are number we have served individually for the whole, that's about 2,397. And then these are the languages spoken by these individuals. And in terms of disability breakdown, these are also the different disabilities we are able to serve. For the COVID was how the impact us in 2021, within 7 months, we were able to provide these services in terms of the rental assistance over close to $9 million we processed it, and also directly provide a rent to the families and some of the food, grocery, and other services as well. So these are all the things we do. That's it.
Thank you, Ginger.
Thank you so much, Ginger. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you so much. Let me open it up to commissioners. Do any commissioners or staff have questions for Ginger?
I do. Chair Piper, this is Tony Esparza. Ginger, could you tell us a little bit, and I apologize if I missed this information, but about your various funding sources for your work?
Yeah, funding sources-wise, it's really broad. We have government funding, like from federal, from states, from local, like King County or city. And then we also have foundations fundings like Seattle Foundation, Satterberg Foundation, Stolte Family Foundation, and Group Health Foundation, and others. And then also individual donors. And then on top of that, we also have fee-for-services, which means that when people need us to do something because we have the language and cultural capacity, then we do service for them. For example, we do the focus group and help people to know what community needs are, and then we charge people for the fee. So there are some different services we do like that. It's called a fee for services. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Great. Any other questions?
This is Sherry. I don't have any questions, but I would just really like to commend you. It's quite an amazing program, Ginger, starting from your basement. So great work.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you to all of our panelists this evening. Thank you so much for taking the time to address the commission this evening. I think it was a really, really insightful series of presentations. So again,
Chair Piper, we have one more organization.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. They were really great. So thank you so far. Absolutely. But we have one more presentation, and that is from Kindering. And I believe the staff presenter is Dr. Lisa Greenwald, the executive director. But I know we also have Gaylene Vaden on the phone. And Gaylene, I apologize. I don't know your job title or if you're presenting along with Dr. Greenwald this evening.
This is Gaylene. I'm the grant writer, a senior grant writer for Kindering, and Lisa can handle this well.
Okay. Well, welcome nonetheless. Thank you. Thank you both for being here this evening. I'll turn it over to you.
Good evening. I am Lisa Greenwald, and I'm hoping you can see my screen. Does it look right to you?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much managing this screen sharing business. So. Thank you. So I am the CEO at Kindering. I'm also a speech language pathologist or therapist by background. I've been associated with Kindering for over 20 years. And most importantly, I'm a parent to a now 17-year-old Kindering alum who has disabilities and special health care needs. So it was great to see Ginger before this and lots of synergies there. All right. So before I get started, I just want to say thank you so much for being here, engaged, interested, and so much support over the years, past, present, and future. Philanthropic revenue is so critical to ensuring Kindering can provide services to all families seeking our care. And the collective investment in 2021 from community partners in Bellevue provided nearly 23% of this. So thank you so much for investing in our kids. And there's some other stats there on the slide that you can see. Here is the quick organization of how we're going to move forward through the day, just a quick bit about Kindering and then move through the pandemic impacts and other unmet needs. So Kindering's programs further our mission of embracing children with diverse abilities and their families by providing the finest education and therapies to nurture hope, courage, and the skills to soar. To strengthen our focus on ensuring equitable access for kids and families, we have adopted our guidepost, Yo Pertenezco, or I Belong. Here's a quick snapshot. You can read a lot of this, but a couple highlights to highlight is that it is our 60th anniversary, so happy birthday to Kindering, and that we serve children to age 11. Directly, and then we also do systems work and consultation, replication, and influence care on the broader spectrum. Okay, so here are our programs divided into three circles of support designed to support children with diverse abilities, families, and our community. A few of them that are highlighted are specific programs that are funded or are opportunities for funding from the City of Bellevue. Of note, the Early Support Program has also been called the Early Intervention Program or the Birth to Free Program, and what we're probably known most well for, so just wanted to mention that. It is not only our largest program, but we're also the largest program in the state and in the Pacific Northwest. And along with our Kids Clinic program, this is the program where we offer occupational, physical, speech therapy, special education, and family resources coordination. And Kindering is a special education system for kids under age 3 in Bellevue. In terms of the highlighted ones, the child care and preschool consultation, which Bellevue currently funds, provides on-site observations, training, and consultations to preschools and child care providers to better equip them to support children in their care, those with developmental challenges or having challenging behaviors. And I know Enrique Hampton has presented to you on this before. Another program that you support is our Families in Transition program called FIT. This is for people experiencing homelessness, which is a focus for you as a commission. And you recently began funding FIT, and we're so grateful. So we partner with housing-focused agencies to support their families in their care, and so that we can support children's development and partnership and help them address so many of the developmental needs that are also there's so many barriers that our families face. So, and then the third is parent education. This is another area of opportunity. The Bellevue Needs Assessment identifies this as a need in, I think, a second tier, and Kindering has provided robust parent supports for many years. And this program has grown significantly over COVID, and I will just bring your attention to the great need that is continuing and emerging in this area in a minute when we talk about pandemic effects. Okay, so demographically, let's see. We serve a diverse group of families, as you imagine, I'm sure, and between 50 to 80 languages are spoken by our families at any given time. We care so much about equitable outcomes for our children and families, so we have an overarching focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion, and advancing this at Kindering has been an ongoing and increasing focus for many years. Let me tell you a little bit about that, which as part of our equity work plan, we've begun embedding equity across the organization, some of the areas in overcoming barriers to services, providing uncompensated care, making sure we're providing services even for families who wouldn't normally be able to pay, translations, interpreters, cultural and linguistic matches with providers whenever possible, tablets, and not just the technology, but the support to use the technology and engage in telehealth. Most recently with the onset of the pandemic. We also look at data and addressing the outcomes through any disparities that are found in our data or in our family feedback in our surveys. And finally, staff, who are key to making the magic of our mission happen. We really are focused on a race equity culture. We provide regular trainings. We have an equity and inclusion officer and a 15-person accessibility, equity, and inclusion team. We have a commitment to hiring and retaining staff that mirrors the diversity of our community. And we've been weaving in our healing-centered trauma-informed practices with our DEI practices for both staff and family. So I'm going to, it's just best to hear it straight from a family. So you know what? I don't think I shared. I'm going to unshare for just 1 second and reshare. I apologize. Okay. Thank you. I have to share sound when I do that. So that was the mistake I made. So I wanted to just share from the family so you can hear this. It's a brief video. Hopefully you'll enjoy that. They tell the story better than I could.
We have been married for 5 years this August.
Last year, we welcomed our very first child, Kalia Joy, into this world, who also has a rare genetic syndrome called Pfeiffer syndrome. It's where the sutures of the skull prematurely fuses. And it's so rare that it's 1 in 100,000.
When the doctor sat us down and gave us her diagnosis and kind of what the future could look like, there was this unknown. There was a lot of unknown.
Right away, as she's born, she started crying right after she came out, which was a great sign because she was getting all the air out and all the liquid out of her lungs, but then she stopped breathing. As a parent and as a first-time parent and as someone who's just overwhelmed with emotions, I didn't know how to feel. All I know was that I was going to be attached to her anywhere she went.
It was like day one that we got reunited as a family, and the doctor came into the hospital room and he kind of shared the trajectory of surgeries. But the first one we couldn't do until she gained some weight. So she was so small. And to think that they're going to do a craniectomy, like I literally went home and like looked it up and just like, you're going to open my baby's skull. And it was those hard moments of knowing that the surgery was going to be the best thing for her, but having to see her get willed away. You become a parent and you feel like you can protect your child from all of these things, and that was quickly taken away from us.
As new parents and as parents of a medically complex child, there's no manual for any of this stuff.
We spent about 5.5 months in the hospital, from the NICU to the floor. We connected with Kindering early on from the hospital when we were getting ready to discharge. We had PT in the hospital, which really helped Callie. And they shared that once we got home, that we would also have some services in home. And this was such a new process for us both of trying to just get home and get acclimated and to find out that we were going to have some resources that were going to help Callie hit those milestones was like, whew. What's so beautiful about Kindering is they come up with a full plan.
Keep coming. Keep coming.
So one of the big milestones that we were working on is for Callie to sit up and then stand and then walk. And the fact that here she is at 15 months sitting up, standing and taking steps is amazing. But Kindering has taught me that for all those steps for her to get there, there's exercises and there's baby steps to get there.
The fact that we've been able to keep it fun, make it a game, she has no idea that what she's doing is actually building towards the goals that we're trying to accomplish, but she just thinks it's just hanging out with mom and dad. Kindering not only came in with this great plan, but they're invested in my daughter and every single milestone that she is reaching for and she's hitting and will continue to reach.
They always say it takes a village to raise a child. We just thought our village was going to be our parents, our family and friends. We did not realize that our village would be Kindering, our nurses, doctors. And so it's a different village, but it's the village that it takes to get Callie to where she needs to be to excel.
And you are that village. I'm talking to the village. So thank you so much for watching that. just due to sake of time, I'm going to go through a couple of these really quickly so we can get to the meat of this. Don't need to rehash all of that's happened since the pandemic, but I do want to answer some of the questions that you have posed, how families have reacted and what the needs are. So we have shifted to all virtual in the beginning. We have more of a hybrid model throughout the pandemic. But there's definitely been a challenge in terms of engaging families in general. There's hesitancy on teletherapy, both from families and from staff, as you might imagine. Really examining the effectiveness and keeping up the great work that we do and making sure it's an effective. And delivering basic needs in partnership with Eastside Baby Corner has been a really, really important thing that we have kept up all the way through this. And then, like I said before, learning technology, yes, but also supporting how to use it and how to access the therapies that we provide.
Lisa, you have about 3 more minutes.
Okay, thank you. So fast. So the other thing that I just wanted people to know is that kids at the beginning of the pandemic stopped really coming to us because they weren't getting developmental screening. And now we are seeing kids coming to us with much greater needs and at much greater levels than before. And today, which you don't have this and we'll send it to you because this is hot off the press today, a journal article came out in Nature about the impacts of the pandemic on young children. And the research is really beginning to show some significant concerns and delays in development, not due to COVID itself, but due to how we responded to the pandemic. You can read a lot of that there. Some protective factors have been kids who continued in some group care. Prenatal, you know, concerns, pregnancy, anxiety, depression, as well as when is the last time you saw a child at the grocery store or a playground full of people? And then, of course, that when you have parents working from home and their attention is focused and split, it's just been a very challenging environment, and its impact on development is of concern. So there's hope. Kindering's here, and infants and toddlers are so resilient, and parent education is so critical so we can make sure we're providing the right things to children and families during this time. And then finally, just our last slide is to help us address unmet community needs in terms of the Bellevue Human Services Commission and some of the things, opportunities that you might have. We have 2,000 square feet of outdoor therapy space and education space that we would love to cover and put a heat source on so that we can be safer outside with some of our services, especially our group services, and understand that that could be something that ARPA recognizes and authorizes. We also would love support in the cost of limiting our, you know, exposure to COVID, PPE, contact tracing, all of that good stuff. And we are well positioned to support the need for parent education. As I've mentioned before, that is a growing need for our children and our families. And then finally, expanded support for families in transition, where we really can expand those services to children who are experiencing homelessness. And I have lots more information and lots of answers to any of your questions, but I'm just sensitive to time and just want to thank you so much for your time so far. All right. Do you have any questions for me?
Thank you so much, Lisa. And do any commissioners have questions for Lisa or Gaylene?
Hey, this is Sherry. I do have a question. How do families traditionally find their way to you? You mentioned developmental screenings. I don't know if it's that from other organizations or what is the pathway to you?
Yes, any pathway and any door is the right way. The most common way has been through our doctors, our pediatricians, the family doctors. And so that was why we really saw that dip, is because people weren't going to those well child visits for a while. But really just getting the word out in the community, and we've really expanded the ways we've tried to get the word out. So yes, but the number one source is through the doctor system, but you do not need a referral from a doctor to come see us.
Great. Thank you. And wonderful video. That was very inspiring.
Thank you. Any other questions? Lisa, I'll just say that as you mentioned in your introduction, that you have a child who's an alum. I do as well, a child who's an alum of the Cherish program, and we had a phenomenal experience. So thank you so much for your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time and your support.
Thank you.
And I believe that's all of our panelists for this evening.
That is.
Sorry, I spoke too soon last time.
It sure is. Thank you.
And well, thank you. Thank you all for your time this evening. For the insightful presentation. Thank you. Great. So the next order of business will be old business. Is there any old business to bring up? All right. Any new business?
One item of new business that perhaps Christy Sanglin would like to share with you is about our presentation to council, or Chair Piper, perhaps you'd like to share about that this coming Monday.
Christy, do you want to go? I know we've talked a little bit about it, but we haven't gone into great detail. So
absolutely.
I'll pass that hot potato back.
So this coming Monday, the 24th, Ben and I will be presenting to Council on the findings of the Human Services Needs Update. So as always, we always encourage commissioners to attend and be in the audience to hear the presentation and hear comments from Council. Of course, the all council meetings are also recorded, so there is always opportunity afterwards if you're not able to attend on the evening for your viewing pleasure. And Ben, I will be in touch with more details hopefully tomorrow.
Thank you.
Yes.
Any other new business?
I think the only other new thing I can think of, and Tony, I didn't talk to you about this before, but Megan Farwell has given her notice, and I don't think we talked about it at a previous meeting, and so her last day will actually be this Friday. So you won't be seeing her at future meetings, and then I know that Dee Dee also sent out an email before this meeting that she will have another month with us. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Tony, because I just jumped in with it and didn't talk about it beforehand.
No, thank you. Thank you for updating them. They've both been a part of our team for a very long time and great contributors. And so you will have a chance to share with Dee Dee at our next meeting.
Fantastic. If there's nothing else, could I get a motion to adjourn?
Tim Bond, motion to adjourn.
Is there a second?
So may I second? Sure.
All right, we are adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.